You're listening to Health Justice Radio Collective on CFMU 93.3.
Hi there, my name is Nikki Bosnoff, and you're listening to the Health Justice Radio Collective. On the board is Eric Brown, and here with me in studio is Professor Lisa Schwartz. She's the Arnold L. Johnson Chair in Healthcare Ethics and an Associate Professor in the Department of Clinical Epidemiology and Biostatistics. She's also the lead author of a study recently published in the Journals of American Bioethics and Public Health Ethics. The paper is called Ethics in Humanitarian Aid Work, Learning from the Narratives of Humanitarian Health Workers. Welcome.
Thanks very much, Nikki. Thanks for having me.
So, what prompted this study question?
The study came from just relationships that I had. So it just happened that I was thinking about getting involved in international aid work of one sort or another, and I started up with the International Women and Children's Health Network here at McMaster. And as I was working with them on preparing one of their conferences, people would tell me stories, and eventually other people, colleagues of mine who had been abroad to do humanitarian work, would tell me stories. And as they were telling the stories, ethical issues would arise, and they'd sort of stop and say, "Well, there's an ethical issue for you," and then they'd pause for a moment and then move on. And I realized nobody had the language to talk about the issues. So one of the things I thought we could do, and given that there was so much moral distress in the stories that they were describing, I thought I could go and look up some information and bring it back to people and say, you know, here's a paper in case you have any thoughts on the issue. But what happened was that when I went looking, there wasn't anything. So we began to realize that there was no framework for discussing the kind of clinical issues that humanitarian healthcare providers encounter when they're in the field, in the same way that we have an awful lot about clinical ethics and clinical ethics resources here in Canada and the United States and elsewhere. But there was nothing equivalent for field workers. So in order to create any kind of resources, it was pretty clear that the first thing we needed to find out was what the stories were. So we started a qualitative study a couple of years ago now, interviewing healthcare professionals, that's doctors, nurses, physiotherapists, other kinds of therapists and practitioners, and asking them about the stories of challenges, ethical challenges they encountered in the field. And we did a sub-study of medical students who'd done international electives as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, I guess the first question that comes up is, are ethical issues universal? You know, why do we need a separate framework for work done overseas? Shouldn't they be the same?
You know, you're absolutely right. I would like to be able to say that everything would be the same, and that the ethical challenges and ethical issues and the principles that guide us will be the same here as they are anywhere else. Some of it is the same, and there is overlap, but there were also stories that we heard that were distinct from stories that we would hear elsewhere, partly because the circumstances, the contexts were often more extreme. I mean, we're talking about aid workers, which means that sometimes they're working in very extreme situations, like immediately after a disaster, tsunami, earthquake, cholera outbreak, you know, the sorts of things, floods that we're seeing now. Some of them were doing longer-term development work, but always doing it with a backdrop of either extreme poverty, so the resources were needed and there weren't the resources weren't available and they were needed, or they're doing it in development after political unrest, where there's a great deal of distrust, where resources are scarce and low. So given all of that, I think it stands to reason that the experiences are going to be somewhat different, and so the guidance that they receive needs to be able to be responsive to that, which doesn't mean that some of the guidance, like the principles that inform good professional ethics, it's not that none of it is going to be the same. It's just that when you're in a situation where you've got patients in a ward, and there's so many patients in a resource restricted ward that they're two to a bed, and some people are sleeping on the floor, then our typical Canadian requirements for privacy and confidentiality go out the window. That's not even an issue there. They're more concerned about other more basic needs. So things do get reoriented and reorganized. Priorities are not the same there, and so it stands to reason that the priorities of ethical decision-making will be different as well.
Mm-hmm. And in your research, how did you define an ethical dilemma?
Well, we were focused, yeah, definitely on the problems, so on the ethical challenge that the individual involved encountered. So what we wanted to know were about times when they just didn't know what was the right thing to do. So maybe they had enough clinical information, but they still couldn't reason through, like the social impact or something else of what was going on. So, yeah, one of the chief issues was, when you don't know what's the right thing to do, or when you know what the right thing to do is, but for some reason you're obstructed from, carrying that out. Maybe because of social differences or because of resource differences, but something intervenes with you being able to carry it out. And then it was also recognizing that sometimes doing what you thought was the right thing would turn out also to have negative consequences as well, and trying to work out, again, how do I go about doing this when I know that in the end things can never be completely right.
Mm-hmm. So in your paper, you write that the challenges that you consider were distinct from wider issues of ethical and political critiques of humanitarianism. So I'm wondering whether critiques of humanitarianism and of Western healthcare professionals going overseas, whether those things did come up, and if they did come up, why you opted to focus on more the challenges that healthcare professionals faced in providing the treatment themselves.
Yeah, I mean, it's an excellent question, and the simple answer is other people were doing it better. So, you know, if you go to do a search, if you do a Google search on the ethics of humanitarian healthcare, you'll find an awful lot, a lot of material, really well considered issues related to the general politics of it, of aid organizations, of how money is spent, of how priorities are set. All of that stuff is being dealt with. We haven't got the solution yet, but it's definitely being dealt with. What we were wondering about was, when it comes right down to it, one individual there, one nurse, one doctor, one care provider was encountering other kinds of problems that went specific, you know, really much, much deeper, and not so broadly as the kinds of big issues around the crisis of humanitarianism, as it's sometimes called. So what we wanted to do was look at those specific, on the ground sort of coalface questions. They do reflect some of that bigger power structure issues. Not all of them do, though, so you'd be surprised that actually some of it is other kinds of questions. Or they're caused up there, but they're still being dealt with somewhat differently down here, and that's what we were trying to capture so that we could be helpful to the aid workers themselves, and in particular, I guess, to the patients that they were helping.
Mm-hmm. So you said that you interviewed a wide variety of healthcare professionals. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me more about how you analyzed what you heard from them?
Yeah, we interviewed people, asking them questions, like I said, specifically on the challenges that they had encountered, the ethical challenges. And we asked each of them to prepare in advance at least three stories of ethical challenges that they encountered, because one of the things we're trying to do also is put together cases for discussion for use in pre-departure training and that kind of thing. So we asked them to prepare the stories, and then afterwards, on the basis of that, transcripts were written up, and actually I saw pretty well just the blinded transcripts at that point. A few of us got together at different kinds of times. We each of the members of the team, and it's an interdisciplinary team, we each of us had all the transcripts. Some of us read all of the transcripts. Some of us read just either portions of or just one or two of the transcripts. And on the basis of that, we kind of tagged to see what sort of themes emerged from the interviews, from the stories that were told. And then we worked together to see what the overlap was of those themes, and then chunked those themes into four main categories for the health professionals. And then for the medical students, we had six categories.
Okay, so we'll go into those kind of categories more in depth in just a minute. But I want to ask you, you say that the analysis is a traditional Western bioethics perspective. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, what does that mean for the relevance of your results to, I guess, non-Western healthcare professionals?
Right. So first of all, actually, the initial analysis has been a grounded theory analysis, which means that we started from the ground up. We look at what the stories are and what the details are, and we labeled on the basis of what was there. I was not involved in the primary analysis. So teammates who are not bioethicists did the primary analysis, which was my hope was that we wouldn't be simply subjecting it to a kind of a theoretical, prejudged theoretical analysis. And then on the second go, I'm doing the more theoretical one that has this bioethics, Western bioethics perspective. So that was one way in which we hoped that it would become more applied. It still means, though, that one of the limitations with the study is that it's told from the perspective of Canadian people, whether that's because the stories were told by healthcare professionals who were expat workers who came from Canada and went places, so we only have their stories, or because of our own analysis as well. So there's no doubt about it that it's problematic in that way. Having said that, though, the stories are still pretty rich, and I think they're still pretty important. And it becomes our next steps now to start looking at it from other ways. And we've been collaborating with some people. There was a report done by MSF Ontario and Quebec and Geneva and MSF International are looking at what they call the Perceptions Project. And they are going to the sites of their various different projects and asking local patients, practitioners, government people about their perceptions of what goes on when MSF does a project or a program in their area. So what's interesting is that what's being said in those studies from the point of view of the locals very interestingly mirrors what we're hearing from the point of view of the expats. Mm-hmm. So that's been another process of validation, which I think has been useful for us. I hope that answers the question.
No, it does definitely. Yeah. So I guess let's just start off with the kind of first theme that you identified, challenges emerging from resource scarcity and the need to allocate them. Can you describe this a bit more?
Mm-hmm. It's probably the least surprising of the four themes. There was no doubt from the stories that we heard in the pilot interviews and the anecdotal stories that I collected before we went into the study that, you know, when you're in the field doing a field operation, there really are limited resources. The hospitals there, the clinics there, the health professionals there are all working under a completely different set of a whole different world of what would be available to them. So as a result, in the stories that we heard over and over again, the practitioners would say, we have those resources here. I'm watching a person die. I'm watching a child die of something that I know could easily have been treated if we had been back in Canada. And over and over and over again, they said, in Canada we have, but here we don't. In Canada we could, but here we don't. And I think it was, you know, one of the sad, very affecting things. So, you know, in particular, premature babies, premature infants, they were having to select between one who that was going to maybe make it through the night and the other that they felt wouldn't, even though that same child would probably survive here in Canada. It seemed to be an accepted norm that you just wouldn't even bother to try because we didn't have the resources to keep them alive.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned also in the paper that where a health professional was bringing funds or resources to the hospital, they found that these kinds of decisions that they had to make with their own money that they brought was straining their relationships.
Mm-hmm. Straining their relationships and making the health professional feel this sort of moral distress of having to choose. They were, you know, she describes, that particular person describes, I was in a position where I had to choose between one patient and another patient, who was going to get this money and who wasn't. And she had strongly recommended that it was better not to come with the money, but to send it later on, and let the locals then, you know, deal with it in the way that they felt was the best way to deal with it, rather than being, you know, as she described herself, sort of this, you know, an individual who comes in, a stranger, and making choices that she didn't feel it was appropriate for her to be making.
Okay, we're just going to take a short break now. Again, I'm in the studio with Professor Lisha Schwartz. She's an ethicist, and we're talking about ethical dilemmas faced by healthcare professionals conducting humanitarian work. Here's Kanon struggling. Okay, we're back in studio. My name is Nikki Bosnoff, and you're listening to the Health Justice Radio Collective. And with me in studio is Professor Lisha Schwartz. She's an ethicist, and we're talking about narratives of humanitarian health workers and the ethical dilemmas that they face. So, Professor Schwartz, in your paper, you identified another important theme that people spoke about, and that was challenges emerging from aid policies and aid agendas.
And that was an important one, and in a way it sort of crept up on us. We began to see how important this was. If I had a nickel for every time one of the respondents said something like, you know, that was made over there, that was made in Geneva, or that was a decision made by the organization, but at the coalface they were having to live with the consequences of those policies or the agendas or whatever it was. So one key area, for example, were the vertical programs. Vertical programs are aid agency programs that target and focus on only a single disease. So they might be a targeted program to deal with cholera or to deal with meningitis outbreaks or to deal with HIV or something like that. And what that means is that lots and lots of resources are poured into providing care for that particular disease, but every other disease around it is ignored. And the health professionals really felt that it was ignored. I mean, I don't think it's necessarily that they're ignored. It's just that that's, you know, the agency is not thinking about it as everything else. They're just thinking about doing one thing extremely well. And the practitioners describe situations where they would be, you know, confronted by two sick children in a hospital, and one of them might have meningitis, which is what the health professional was there to treat. And they would say things like, well, you know, I have the antibiotics in the truck. I can come in here and I can give antibiotics to that person with meningitis. But the kid in the bed next to him, this was one of the stories, the kid in the bed next to him has a gangrenous foot. And I know I have the medication, he says. I know I have the medication, but I can't give it to the kid with the gangrenous foot because that's not what I'm there to treat. So vertical programs, like they said, they do extremely well for one set of circumstances, but the practitioners had to live with the experience of having to say, I can't treat something else, and knowing that as they were walking away, they were somehow compromising their professional obligations by not treating the other person. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, though, you know, they kept coming back to the sense that they were... They knew that if they started to provide care for everyone kind of ad hoc that way, that it would open up the floodgates and there would just be no stopping it. So they felt a little bit reassured that they were making the right choice from a policy perspective and from a public health perspective, but they weren't comfortable with what they were living with.
Mm-hmm. It seems like when healthcare professionals do make the decision to go abroad and to help with humanitarian work, or at least a lot of medical students, they go with kind of the feeling that they'll be helping. And I think that what your study brings out is often that they feel helpless.
Yeah.
So can we talk a bit about that more?
Yeah, it's pretty unfortunate that, you know, what they described often was going feeling empowered to do something and empowered to empower other people and help other people and make that, you know, make the situation better, even by increments, and very often felt pretty overwhelmed by what they could and could not do. It happened in different scales. The students really often do go thinking very clearly that they want to go and help and find themselves in a situation where not only are they not helping, but they're a burden to the system. Because when they go on international health electives, they go as raw, you know, unskilled observers. And then they begin to recognize that because they're learners, they're also taking time out from the schedules of the busy professionals who are showing them the works, you know, who are showing them around. So when they thought that they'd be able to help, actually they're draining resources. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty difficult. I think probably one of the most important things to know before a student embarks on an international elective like that is to recognize that what they're doing is not going to be of service. They're going to learn. And what is wanted and expected of them at the other end in the host institutions is that they learn what the realities are like for people in this kind of a setting, and then come back later on when they are skilled, or tell their friends, and their friends will come back when they are skilled and have something to offer. So it's a consciousness raising and an educational process. That's what good is coming out of it, mm-hmm. not the kind of help that one does. Having said that, there are other ways to help, right? So, mm-hmm. And I always describe my friend Phil Cotton, who from Glasgow. When he brings students on health electives, he makes them do other sorts of things. So on their free time, they're painting wards and cleaning up departments so that things can get on in the way that they're meant to. So it may not mm-hmm. be medical work, but at least they're helping out, and that's good.
Right. So have you seen any examples of other types of offsetting, you know, offsetting the burden that they feel? Because we did also discuss about how, you know, you bring money or you bring gifts, and then all of a sudden you're put into the position of being kind of the distributor of these, and then you get all these strains on your relationship. So
yeah, and the respondents were pretty clear about that they felt, don't bring it yourself. Mm-hmm. Send it, don't bring it. Having said that, though, a lot of people described going with a full suitcase and coming back with an empty suitcase. So whatever clothing you bring, or books you bring, or, you know, any kind of resources, the protective gear that you bring, like gloves or masks, what you don't use, leave behind. Mm-hmm. Don't think that you're going to come back with that stuff. And that can be pretty useful as well. And then reciprocal agreements, and that's something that's also being recommended by the AFMC document on international health electives for medical students, is recognizing that the whole institution, that McMaster, is developing relationships with medical schools elsewhere, like in Uganda. So if there can be a reciprocal arrangement gone on, then that means that other kinds of goods will come of it, like people coming here as an exchange, for example, or faculty going over to provide support and help. That's another kind of offsetting, as you put it. It's a good way to put it.
Mm-hmm. So just quickly, were there any other, like, really salient themes that came out from the med student specific mm-hmm. part of the study?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you hear about med students who think they're going to go over and they're going to try out things that they can't do here. So it's pretty important that all students recognize that they have limitations. And the limitations are very clearly legal limitations here. So if it's illegal for you to do something here, then it's going to be illegal for you to do it there. If it's illegal to perform an appendectomy by yourself here, it's illegal to perform an appendectomy there, which doesn't mean that you can't learn. You know, people are going there as learners, and if you're supervised and you're assisting in things, and you've got the opportunity to practice and then try one on your own in the same way that you would do here, properly supervised, then that's fine. That's education, that's learning, and that's what it's about. But going thinking that you're going to perform procedures that you're not supposed to perform here, don't do that.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, there's lots more that we could talk about, but let's just quickly, if you want to thank the other authors on the study, and also maybe mention the conference that you have coming up.
Right. So November 26th and 27th, we have a symposium, really, just a small group of us, and we're talking about ethical issues in humanitarian health care, and people coming from around the world for that. And I do want to thank our respondents, because these stories that they shared with us were remarkable. people, and then also my teammates, and there's a long list of Chris Sinding in particular from here, from Mac. It's Chris Sinding, Naomi Adelson from York University, Linda Redwood Campbell and Lori Allett, both doctors here at McMaster and educators, Sonia DeLatt and Jennifer Ranford, who've done the interviews and analysis, and Matthew Hunt, who is our fellow research fellow.
Great. Thank you so much. This was the Health Justice Radio Collective on CFMU 93.3. We'll see you next week.